This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 78th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week we have for your listening pleasure a textbook edition of a cultural show, a manual on arts coverage, something we hope you want to cut out and keep, swap with your pals, collect the set. Looky here. We'll be in São Paulo with our credit card and a hit list of the best galleries to buy from at SP Arte, South America's best art fair.
The artist families and the artists are very excited about this. They're excited about Brazil. They're saying yes, but when they usually say no. I think that is very much like the elemental reality of Brazil.
And we'll nip to Dublin to meet the man who's made one of the most charming filmic portraits of a land and a people, dresses, draining boards and all.
Well, the goal wasn't to make a film at all. It was really just I was going around a local farm saying I just wanted to document what furniture they had. And they were a bit surprised, so I then expanded out the brief to say I'm just looking at farm history. And they were much more comfortable with that.
And of course, we'll have some hijinks in the form of a live Midori House session, courtesy this week of New Orleans' Hot 8 Brass Band. We'll meet Hong Kong's virtuoso pop star, pianist, composer, and we'll hear from the man behind a website that promises to make it easier to be a journalist. That's all here on Culture, with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So let's kick off the week in style with this, a group who've been described as marching music for the modern age. A bundle of energy from New Orleans, the Hot 8 Brass Band blend traditional brass sounds with funk, hip-hop and jazz. They stopped by recently and now hold the title here at Midori House as the only band to come in and play one continuous set. But for the sake of the show, we've managed to chop things up a bit for you to enjoy. Let's start with this, their latest single, which is out now. This is their take on that classic by The Specials, Ghost Town.
We'll be right back.
And that is how you do it. That was the Hot 8 Brass Band with Ghost Town, the Specials cover, their latest release. And we'll hear more from the group later on in the show. A bit of housekeeping now, kind of. My next guest is a freelance writer and editor who always found it a pain to get his pitches read, commissioned, and once done, if they were, paid for. So many good ideas go to waste because there's no central space for them to be seen and heard, he seems to be saying. So he set up a website, pitchme.org, that puts journalists and publishers in touch so that the dog can see the bone and vice versa. It's an ideas shop, a sort of story bank. Good idea, huh? His name is Kabir Chibba, and I chatted to him earlier on about the nuts and bolts of PitchMe.
PitchMe is a one-stop shop for ideas, basically. It's a marketplace for stories. So writers can come on, they can pitch their stories there. So you have a listings of all the pitches that are there. Editors can come to the site and buy them. And that's really that simple. So
presumably you have to subscribe to it. You have to presumably pay. If you're me, if you're an editor at a magazine, you have to pay to use the service. This is how you guys make some money, right?
In the initial stages, we're still working on things now. So if you're a writer, you come on and it's a request, an invite. So if we approve you, you can come on the site and you can use it and you pay a small fee plus a percentage, something in the order of $15 or £12 plus 3% of your fee. If you're a subscriber in terms of an editor, that's working on a different basis at the moment. So we're looking at a subscription model, we're looking at other models as well. But yes, eventually at some point there'll be some mix of the two.
And is it sort of based more for freelance writers? Did the genesis of it come from being maybe a frustrated freelance writer or an ambitious one, or from being an editor? Because I think you're a little bit of both, right?
I am a bit of both, yes. I've been a writer for the New York Times and Harper's and various other magazines, Esquire and things like that for a few years now. And it's extremely frustrating experience. You know, you pitch to editors, it takes ages to get paid, it takes ages to get expenses cleared, and then your editor gets fired and you have to start all over again, or you move and you have to start all over again. And I've also commissioned writers, and I found it to be a really frustrating process to get writers to kind of do the things that you want them to do, or to find the quality writers that you wanted. So it was kind of a solution to a lot of problems. And I was having a particularly bad experience with an article last year, having things paid for it, and it just was ridiculous. I thought there has to be a better way, and it sort of, this idea came to me, and I've been working on it ever since.
Because there's also, as you're alluding to there is as part of PitchMe, part of the deal is about getting paid, isn't it, and making that easier, that process easier. I know that I know what it's like. I sat next to the managing editor here at Monocle, for example, and he has to take a lot of phone calls and juggle a lot of kind of expenses claims and, as you say, and invoices from people.
And there's a lot of email tennis as well, just back and
forth. It's a lot of stuff, yeah. Everyone's sort of trying to put everyone else off at the same time.
I think what I find is that you spend all your time wanting to write something really, really cool, but you spend all your actual time dealing with all this crap, so to speak, expenses, all these payments, chasing things up, and you can't make a living off of it. I think that was what I found to be the most annoying thing. You have a rent payment due at whenever you have it due, and your payment's not going to come for another 3 months for arbitrary reasons. And so what we wanted to do is take away all the payment stuff. So we pay the writer up front 50%. 50% comes after the article is published, so the writer can make a living off of it, and the editor just doesn't have anything to do with that anymore. He can deal with that later on, 6 months down the road when he's finished publishing. So we take care of all the payment stuff. You just concentrate on the words.
So magazines, newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, mm-hmm. whatever it might be, who are commissioning writers through PitchMe, do they kind of have a contract with you then? The onus is kind of between you and them.
I think it's a sort of two-way contract. When you negotiate with your, if you're an editor and you negotiate with your writer, you negotiate exactly how you want the contract to be. It sort of changes live on the page in a kind of cool fashion. So, for example, one of the people we have on the site is the Atavist, who are these lovely long-form storytellers from New York, and they don't pay people at all. They do everything in terms of royalties. So they can get rid of everything and just be, you know, we'll pay you 50% royalties after a certain amount of time. You know, you can agree that kind of thing. So what happens is the writer and the editor agree the contract. They do all that kind of stuff. They're happy with that. And as part of the using PitchMe service, we take care of that. So whatever you agree on, we pay 50% up front, 50% there. So we take care of all the payment system. We deal with the editor through the back end. And we try and make it so neither side actually has to worry about that. You just negotiate the fee and the fee is taken care of.
So I'm a writer. I've got this fantastic story about God knows what. Uh-huh. Maybe it's difficult to get a story about the intricacies of cricket into Monocle magazine, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I've tried this before. Or I want to get it anywhere. I want to get it published by someone decent, clearly, and get paid okay for it. What do I do? What's the process for me pitching my stories, uploading it onto your website? How does it work?
At the moment now, you'd have to request an invite and give a little bit of a bio to yourself. So we take a look and we'd see that you're the kind of writer that would benefit from the system. And that's not to be cruel to writers or to get rid of people. It's just that I think at this initial stage, you know, we have several hundred writers on and we're running at something something quite insane recently, you know, 50 invite requests a day. And so we don't want to have people out there who won't get the full benefit of the service. So first of all, you'd have to do that. Once you sign up, you'd put all your details in there, you know, who you've worked for in the past. There's a couple of cool things that are on there that kind of form part of your profile, like, you know, what's the favorite piece you've ever written? And what's your dream piece? Because every writer has dream pieces, what they really want to do, not the kind of stuff they want to do. So you might be the, you know, culture editor of Monocle and you love it, but really what you want to do is write about cricket all the time, all day long, 24 hours a day, write about cricket. So that might be your dream. And so you can write that. And so if a cricket editor or a sports editor of another newspaper sees that, they'll say, oh, what he really wants to do is write about cricket. He's passionate about the project. Then you just simply go to a section called Create Your Pitch. You'd put all your ideas in there. You'd put in a headline. You'd put in a word count. You'd put in a rough fee, which is the start of negotiation. You put in your pitch. And that's it. And one other thing to add is that some writers were concerned about their ideas being stolen, which we don't think is a particularly big deal.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That's because it's a kind of open forum, isn't
it? It is an open forum. What we do to prevent that is, one, of course, we know who's on the site. So in a certain sense, as a moot point, if you see something there, it's clearly theft. But if you're a writer and you go on the site, you can only look at the synopsis of things. So only editors, which we call publishers and pitchers are the two people on the site. Only publishers can look on the site and see the full proposal with the full word count, with the full thing. So everybody else can just sort of see a headline and a few lines to get them going. And that's proving to be quite useful at the moment because writers are liking each other's. So our page, our front page is based on popularity. So writers are liking each other's works and publishers are liking each other's the works that they see. And that pushes things up and down the front page, which is coming to a really nice, interesting mix of, you know, China and Congo.
Right, so your front page is almost like a front page.
Exactly.
It's the best or the most important story.
Absolutely. And very soon there will be a sort of ticker on there as well. So we're going to start mimicking a lot of the functionality that, you know, writers and editors are used to. So you'll have a ticker there saying a piece was sold. You know, there's a writer and an editor talking as we speak. And they'll hopefully sign something by today or tomorrow. So it'll be there, you know, new sale today. 4 new pitches on the site today. We've had 8 pitches in the last 3 days or so, but there's not that many forums for us to tell people about that.
As overseeing the site, you must be excited. We won't go into maybe specific stories. I don't know that we can do that. But you must be excited about some of the stuff that's gone up there and thought, God, when I was writing and when you were editing, that these are things you'd love to have commissioned.
Absolutely.
I guess you still can.
I still can commission, And I think that's one of the beauties of it. And I pitch. There's, you know, if you look on the site, you'll see some of my ideas on there, stuff that I really wanted to tell. Some things are really esoteric. One actually is about cricket. And another one
is... We're both going to get a job here, aren't we?
Hopefully, yes. Yeah, I think
that's what we're doing.
So we'll start Cricket Monthly. Basically, and just commission writers to pitch me.
This show's big in Australia right here. It's going to be fine. We're going to emigrate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the weather will hopefully be better than here.
Yes, exactly. But we should point out to our listeners in Oz that we both walked through a snowstorm to get to the studio today.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. So we were moaning about that and our bus rides. So the two combinations were just not good.
Exactly. That was me speaking to Kabir Chibba, founder of PitchMe.org. And you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're back with South America's finest art fair after this.
From the historic center of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on Monocle.com.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where in a moment we'll enjoy some Irish charm. But first we're jetting off to Latin America. This past weekend, Brazil's biggest city, São Paulo, hosted SP Arte, the biggest art fair on the South American continent. About 25,000 people attended the fair, which was host to 110 galleries, 41 of which were from outside Brazil. The Brazilian market, although still quite small, continues to grow, and it's one of the few art markets globally with a positive trade balance. Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter went to SP Arte to see what some of the galleries had to offer to Brazil's art collectors.
It's opening day here at the 9th annual SP Arte Art Fair in São Paulo. Art investors and fanatics saunter in and out of over 100 gallery booths here to see if anything piques their interest. Here, they have their pick of prime art with galleries like New York's Van Gogh selling original Picassos, like the 1965 Tête d'Homme. The price? Well, that secret remains tucked away in back negotiation rooms, only for seriously interested buyers to know.
In the particular place we're standing, we're looking at a John Wesselmann painting from 78.
That's Victoria Gelfin, director at New York's Gagosian Gallery, which is making its first appearance at SIPARCHI. It's brought about 50 works to show here, showing everything from impressionist modern works to contemporary art. There is one Jeff Koons piece that is attracting a lot of attention.
We're very excited to be showing this piece. It's the first time it is shown. The title of the piece is Dog Pool Ladder, and it was created in 2007, but only finished now. So this kind of work is incredibly labor-intensive, amazingly cutting-edge. It looks very simple and light. It looks like a children's toy on a basic construction ladder, but in fact, it's made out of aluminum, and it's sanded down by hand, and every tiny dent and detail is handmade, hand-painted. It's an extremely complicated process, really working at the absolute cutting edge of technology.
Just beside the Gagosian booth is Pace, a London, New York, and Beijing-based gallery which has also brought some big names in the art world, like works by Impressionist painter Rothko, an impressive collection for the gallery's first appearance in Sao Paulo. It also represents the Alexander Calder estate, an artist who had a big connection with Brazil, says Mark Limpscher, the owner of the gallery.
The first person New Yorker in the art world to really get it about Brazil was Calder. This piece is actually from that period when he was in Brazil, but it's never been seen before. It's been in the Roxbury studio since it was made, and the family has let us have it here.
He says the interest in Brazil has taken off in recent years.
The artist families and the artists are very excited about this. They're excited about Brazil. They're saying yes when they usually say no. I think that is very much like the elemental reality of Brazil, is when you would normally say no, you say yes. Yeah, everyone, you know, this is where the energy and the optimism is right now in the world and in the art world. You know, the artists and the artist estates want to be part of it.
Pace and Gagosian galleries aren't the only newcomers who are looking to inch into the Brazilian market. A major lure has been a reduction in the normally hefty import tax. Director of SIPARCHI, Fernanda Fetoas, explains.
New galleries are coming every year, and especially this year and last year, we had a higher number of foreign galleries, exactly because of the tax reduction, which we lowered from 50% to approximately 15%. This is very beneficial to foreign galleries to do business in Brazil. It also benefits local Brazilian galleries because they can repatriate works of Brazilian artists that have been abroad, have been produced abroad, or have been sold abroad, and are being bought back by local collectors.
Now, export taxes are very low, so taking art out of Brazil hardly impacts business. With tax reductions, sales are expected to top those from last year, which are estimated to have been between 150 and 180 million US dollars. Fernanda explains which work tops this year's price list.
It's around $10 million. I think it's the Rothko. We have a couple of Rothkos. We have Sugimoto's, we have Portinari's, Di Cavalcanti, Volpi. I wouldn't be surprised if we sell in aggregate approximately $200 million.
In fact, Brazil is one of few countries that has a positive trade balance in the art market. But that's not necessarily a good thing. David Roberts, correspondent for French magazine Journal des Arts, explains more.
Logically, you always want to have a positive trade balance, but in art, you usually prefer having a negative trade balance. Why? Because if you have a positive trade balance, it means that people like your artists. That's the first good thing. But it means also that you don't have the means to keep your artists in your own markets, in your own collections, in comparison to foreign collectors. This is the case of Brazil.
Indeed, Brazil is losing much of its homegrown contemporary art, as Ana Letícia Fialho explains. She's an art consultant with Latitude, a 9-year-old project that represents Brazilian galleries abroad. Since the project started in 2005, she estimates that there has been a 350% increase in the market. And just in the past 3 years, Brazilian galleries have seen a 44% increase in business. But with most of the art being sold to personal collections, the Brazilian public is left in the dark when it comes to viewing these pieces.
The market's growing mainly due to private collectors. They represent 70% of the sales. And the Brazilian institutions are really on the bottom. They are responsible for around 5% of the business. And that's because, unfortunately, if we have in one hand a very dynamic market and an expanding market, we don't see the same in the institutions. They are struggling. They are not solid. Most of them, they don't have clear acquisition policies or budgets dedicated to acquire contemporary art market. And that's due to the lack of cultural policy that needs the hand of the government.
She suggests what could be done to make Brazilian contemporary art more available to the Brazilian public.
Maybe a partnership between the institutions and the private collectors in order to have part of this amazing production also shown in public institutions.
With the likes of famed private art collectors like Kate Moss in attendance at SCP Archi, it's doubtful that there will be a dramatic shift to display some of these artworks in Brazilian institutions, unless, of course, they are donated to the public good. With new galleries having brought over solid collections this year, SCP Archi appeared to be a success, and it's sure to keep growing. But with Brazil's art market increasing as others slump, SCP Archi is becoming more international and growing, meaning that there might be a growing interest to preserve the country's contemporary art scene on Brazilian soil. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena, and this is Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, it was an unlikely hit at the Sundance Festival this year, a stop-motion animation film about farm furniture made in Tipperary in rural Ireland. It's the second film from Tony Donoghue, combining photos, audio recordings and long conversations with farmers living in remote locations in Tipperary into 8 minutes of charming documentary which never drifts into quaintness. The film was made using green principles, a second-hand camera bought for €150, a bike for transportation and a strictly local focus to the subject matter. Reporter Louise Williams met Tony Donoghue in Dublin.
Well, the goal wasn't to make a film at all. It was really just I was going around my local farm saying I just wanted to document what furniture they had. And they were a bit surprised, so I then expanded out the brief to say I'm just looking at farm history. And they were much more comfortable with that.
Irish folk furniture, so that's the title of it. It's not easy to make a short, entertaining, playful film, animated film about inanimate objects. But you use sound and you have the furniture going up garden paths and down boreens, down little roads. So you do bring it to life.
Well, the first problem is that furniture as a subject is probably the most unsuitable subject for a film because people think, you know, the most inanimate, boring thing. So decided to do it animation-wise and giving each piece of furniture a slightly different personality. One maybe a little pig-like, one like nervous-like, that the audience pick up on, but they don't see it as a full anthropomorphic character. That was the first part. And secondly, coming through from the Dadas and Surrealists, there's a great tradition of animating coffins and things in real situations that, you know, an audience used to live action and an audience used to animation just being drawn characters, they're not used to seeing a coffin suddenly sliding along the road. So I just tapped into what filmmakers in the 1920s like Hans Richter had turned into a great art form.
Central to your film is the dresser. Do you want to explain what a dresser is and what a dresser does in an Irish farm?
Well, I suppose probably the easiest way to describe a dresser is in two different contexts. One, it's an evolution of just a set of shelves on the wall. And secondly, in terms of its evolution, there's also a debate that it came from a four-door press and you just took the two doors off the top. So basically, you have open shelves on the top normally and closed shelves on the bottom. But then from about the 1920s to the 1970s, there was a fashion of putting glazed doors on the top, even on old dressers, to keep the dust off them. So effectively, it's display and storage. And the irony is, you know, for a Catholic country, our interiors were very modest, but the dresser was the one thing that was allowed to be totally ostentatious. You could have the shiniest, glossiest ornaments there possible. And it just looked, it just made it shine.
But tell me, what is it about them that you like that you hadn't seen in them before?
Simplicity, I'd say. Most of it, you know, and just everything was put together very, very basically. no real joints, a lot of even nails. And nails would be rusted out now, screws would be bigger than what maybe you should have been using. Everything was so simple. Just it fulfilled what its job, what I had to do in the house, you know.
Yeah. A lot of people, when they think of the rural interior, they think only of the dresser. But the irony is that actually, in parallel with the dresser, was nearly always either a two-door or four-door press. But we lost nearly all of those in the 60s because they were shipped to America by the container load to be used as entertainment centres. People stripped out the shelves and put their big oversized tellies and their recorders into them. So, you know, a lot of people don't even think of these big presses. So really, the rural interior would be marked by an open, the rural peasant cottage, let's say, as opposed to the strong farmer, would be marked by an open fireplace, a dresser normally opposite it, with its back often being the partition wall to the bedroom, and then a settle bed, a stretcher table, and maybe the four-door press.
On the very top here, there was two Willer pattern dishes. On this here now, there was two smaller dishes, Willer pattern. There was all the mugs was hanging along here, on hooks. The big plates was here, and the small plates was in the bottom. Oh, there was cups here. There was a row of cups here and a row of mugs below.
So let's look at this film. You know, it's really getting under the skin of people who live in remote areas, down little roads, even without water or electricity. And it lands in Sundance and gets a super-duper prize. It must have been a bit of a surprise to you.
The main thing was it getting into Sundance. They had 8,103 short films apply, of which they chose, I think it's either 65 or 75. So that was the hard bit to believe. But it wasn't so hard this time because my previous film got in there. And then it was only after that I realised the film just wasn't about one small integrated community in Tipperary. That could have been a community in Korea or France or Germany. So basically people responded to it as a community film rather than a specifically Irish film. The details were Irish. The social structure was any pre-industrial agricultural society. So when the first one got into Sundance, I was absolutely shocked. I thought they'll never go for another one of these. So when the second one got in, I was even more shocked. The award is like the icing on the cake. It was very nice. But for me, for it to play in Sundance with all the big hitters was by far the major prize.
You said that it's Korean schools are using it. Can you give us a picture of how it's being seen around the world?
Yeah, the first film was called A Film for My Parish Six Farms, and because it dealt with the community and it was about recording your local community with very simple equipment, the Green Film Festival in Korea asked about using it in schools to encourage Korean children to record their own grannies and their own cousins and their own neighbours. Because we're not just talking about recording the exotic, we're actually talking about recording your mother, talking about her first car, just to log her inflection, her expression, because, you know, her inflection, her expression might also be a reflection of a larger community, whether it's people from Wexford or whatever, or women of 20 who own a Ford Capri. But, you know, it will have its own importance.
That was Irish director Tony Donoghue there speaking to Louise Williams. And if you want to enjoy this charming little film, and we recommend you do, just search for Irish Folk Furniture online. YouTube, to be honest, might be your best bet. Still to come in part two, we'll be getting the full horn section with the Hot 8 Brass Band. We'll cross to Bamako to hear from the son of one of Africa's most famous photographers, and we'll meet avant-garde composer Siming To and her mum, no less. Lots of reasons to stay on board the good ship culture here on Monocle 24. So let's have a bit more fun with the New Orleans group, the Hot 8 Brass Band. From their non-stop Midori House session, here's their take on Basement Jax's energetic masterpiece, Bingo Bango. And after they'd worn us all out here, Raymond, Jerome and Terrell from the band sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall. Thank you.
Usually on our shows, we try to keep the music flowing continuously without any gap or anything to it, you know.
That really just cuts the time of, you know, talking and everything, of, you know, asking everybody, how y'all doing, y'all all right? You know, when we keep the music going and when we constantly play, it makes it move quicker, you know, so.
Yeah, kind of leave out dead space. Yeah. You know, right. Dead space between our music, yeah.
But within that sort of continuous bit of music, obviously there was Ghost Town in there, and there was a bit of Basement Jacks like Bingo Bango in there. How do you pick the songs that you play? Because I mean, they're both sort of British acts, actually, aren't they? Like, is British music important to you guys, or is it just whatever sounds good at the time?
Actually, it's like whatever sounds good, because before, you know, those songs was given to us by True Thoughts. The album was finished. The album was completely done, and they thought it was a good idea. And when we listen to the songs, we try to put our own twist to them. As you know, they don't sound nothing like, you know, the original tune. So it felt good, you know, to redo them, and it made the album.
And tell like listeners a little bit about some of the background to how the Hot 8 Brass Band came together. I mean, you guys are from New Orleans, and you've been going since like the mid 90s, right? What's been some of the sort of highlights of that journey from then to here?
Most of the guys that went to high school together, they're from a high school, from L.C. Fauchier High School, and they all came together to form the band. At that time, they were called the Looney Tunes?
We was the Hot 8 at high school.
Oh, you was the Hot 8?
Yeah,
okay.
We was the Looney Tunes before that, and then before that was the Blue Note. And some of the guys graduated from high school, so we had another band, the High Steppers, and we combined those two bands together to form the Hot 8. And it's been rolling ever since, the Hot 8, the name Hot 8, but, you know, we started off as, you know, youngsters.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it comes from a really rich culture of, like, kind of right. Marching bands, and there's a lot of other marching bands, aren't there? It's like there's a lot of other people sort of doing
right, well,
this
we
kind of thing, and like there's the to-be-continued brass band, and is it right that you guys sometimes sort of share members with that kind of thing, or?
Well, it's not a marching band.
Right.
Let's, you know, get that understood. It's not a marching band, it's a brass band.
Hmm.
And they have a lot of bands coming up right now, brass bands. Like I say, a lot more than what it was when how they first started. You know, and I'm glad they're keeping the culture going. And it's, when we don't have any gigs, you know, so we gig whenever the phone rings. So it might be, you know, the Rebirth, it might be the Dirty Dozen, it might be the Trim Me, it might be the TBC, whoever calls, you know. So, you know, this is how we make our living, of just playing music. So when you call, we go and make the gig. And, you know, I'm happy to say that I make a living off of music, you know.
And I guess these shows, they take you around the world. I mean, do you get a different reaction from sort of different countries to you know, the music? I mean, do some people take to it more? Do some people sort of take to it less? Like, where's your favorite place to play?
Well, most of the places we've been, the people have been receiving us very well. They love the music. But there's some places, a couple of places we perform, the people seemed like they didn't know what to expect or how to react to the music. And we kind of like let them know, that this is party music, this is happy music. This is music you can, you feel something, get up and do something. Feel, you know, don't, you don't have to sit there being afraid to express yourself with the music. That's one thing about this music, is the audience also participate, which also feeds energy to the band also, yeah.
And that probably feeds back into the kind of music you pick to play, because it has to be kind of immediate and just get people going straight away.
Right.
Or do you ever sort of take it down a notch and kind of slow it down?
We can go to New Orleans traditional music. It's basically whatever. I mean, whatever the gig calls for, that's what sound you would get. Mm-hmm. You know, so traditional sound would be totally different. If we used to play a traditional song right now, someone might think it's a different band because the sound is going to change because of the style of the music. So that's one thing that, you know, that we good at, making sure that the different styles of music we can be able to play, especially coming from New Orleans. You got Zydeco, you got different type of music. So, but we learn how to fit everything in. Or we could even blend all that in one song and it just blow people's mind.
That was Raymond, Jerome and Tyrell from the Hot 8 Brass Band speaking there to Tom Hall. And the group are on tour now in North America. Just go to hot8brassband.com for more details. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It's Monocle 24, where I'm going to leave you for a moment. When I'm back, we'll be hopping on a plane to Mali.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily monocolumn bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 2525 city guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. This is Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. You're listening to Monocle 24. We're now off to that great continent, Africa. Malik Sidi Bey is one of Africa's most famous photographers, an artist who began shooting Malian people in his studio before independence and has since exhibited in galleries all over the world. He's attributed with showing for the first time how Africans looked and dressed away from the colonial gaze. Now Malik is retired, his son Karim has taken over. Rose Skelton went to the studio in Bamako to find out how the legacy of Malik Sidi Bey lives on.
On a narrow street in a central part of town, Karim Sidi Bey steps inside a single-roomed concrete building and points to a pile of cameras stacked up in a dusty corner. All along one wall are rows of the old machines, dating back 50 or more years, belonging to his father, the legendary artist and winner of the 2003 prestigious Hasselblad Award, Malik Sidi Bey. In another corner is a small area lined with black and white linoleum and the iconic striped curtain hanging behind it. A single stool sits in the middle, the place where thousands of photos that have since been shown around the world were shot. The studio hasn't changed in all that time.
Since 1960, the studio has existed with the same materials. The backdrop, mats on the floor, the lights. He hasn't changed anything. Ambient light, light umbrellas, it carries on.
Malik was one of the first photographers on the continent to show Africans as they wanted to be shown. His black and white photos captured people in the studio with their most prized possessions, like sheep, motorbikes and ghetto blasters, and dressed in their finest outfits. This made a complete change from the colonial photos of the day, which showed Africans bare-breasted and covered in beads or tribal scarring. But today the studio is struggling and Karim faces some tough choices. As digital technology has become readily available in Mali, the Sidi Bey studio is one of the only analog photo studios left. On the other side of town sits the competition, a brightly painted digital photo studio bustling with clients. The shop window is covered with digital prints of famous people, and the window display floor is covered in rolls of old analog film. A decorative relic of a bygone era. A young Tuareg man called Arbi works in his uncle's studio. He explains why people like coming to have their photo taken here.
Bon, les gens ne sont pas les mêmes.
Some people like to be photoshopped, to make them lighter, and some like natural colouring. Some like us to change the background, and we do that here. Before, we only had analogue, and we were happy with it. But now everything is done with a memory card, which is much easier.
But back in the studio Sidi Bey, Karim has found what he considers a remedy, something which is bringing clients back to his business and allowing him to do something creative. And while it utilizes digital technology, it also calls on newfound interest in history and tradition. In the past, the trend has been to photograph people against cityscape backdrops of New York or Paris to make them look well-traveled and cosmopolitan. But now Karim finds that many of his clients in this rapidly urbanizing country are nostalgic for their ancestral villages, which many have not ever seen.
I often go to the countryside, really deep into the bush, looking for nice places to take photos. Then when I take photos of my clients, I use Photoshop and put them in these places, which makes them happy. When you see the round huts, you think, ah, I'm at home. It's been so many years since I saw that place. It helps them not miss their villages too much.
Since the conflict in Mali began a year ago, and the desert north of the country has been cut off to much of the population, Karim has had Tuareg people, who are from the north of the country, visit his studio. They ask him to photograph them and superimpose their image onto a desert landscape. Recently, Karim showed his father one of these digital photos and was nervous about how he might react.
My father said he was really happy. He said it was another kind of photography that he had never thought about. I explained that there are people who want to see images of their village, their place, to feel less homesick. It's thanks to digital photography that I've been able to do it. That's why I now say that digital photography is welcome here.
Karim's passion is still black and white photography, in the style that his father pioneered. But alongside the old cameras which sit in the studio waiting to be repaired, there is now a long row of digital cameras sitting alongside them. For Monocle in Bamako, I'm Rose Skelton.
To end the show today, we're going to cross from Bamako and back to London to meet an intriguing artist who's based in this fair city. Categorising composer Siming To is no easy task. The opera-trained and at times avant-garde singer and musician has contributed to the works of artists ranging from the folky musings of Robert Wyatt, the dance music experimentalism of 808 State's Graham Massey, and Simian Mobile Disco and Arctic Monkeys super producer James Ford. To comes from a family of musicians, her mother being a Hong Kong-born classical pianist Enloch Wu, and her latest work, Songs for My Grandmother, is just that, an ode to family fondly remembered. She was performing at London's prestigious South Bank Centre a few weeks ago, and both mother and daughter, something of a Midori house first, stopped by to play some songs and share a few thoughts with Tom Hall.
I won't forget
a couple of songs are from this song cycle called Songs for My Grandmother, based across three generations of women. And my inspiration has been my grandmother. And I interviewed her some time ago and worked with a poet called Judy Kendall. And we formed, lyrics, poetry together and things that I've sort of conversations that we've had with her. And so stories of history of from my grandmother and also just thoughts about my grand. So that's what the lyric content is. And I've composed for my mum to play. She's an acclaimed concert pianist. She really plays very well.
Change that will change every move, every breath, holding on, slowing down, let go of breath.
That was quite a sort of sedate set that you played out there, but I mean,
yes.
But you've done, you know, a huge range of other kind of styles of music. I mean, you've worked with like Graham Massey of 808 State, which is kind of, he's very famous for sort of making massively pumping dance tunes and stuff. And
yes.
How did you arrive on a kind of musical journey to where you are now? What kind of other projects have you worked on before?
Well, you mentioned Graham. I met Graham and Paddy Steer, who heads Home Life. And Home Life and Tool Shed, which was Graham Massey's band.
That's like a sort of improvisational kind of thing, right?
Yeah, a kind of massive mayhem of sound. We've had with Graham's Tool Shed, we've had four drummers on stage in one go, and it was really loud and brilliant.
Have you ever had your mum on stage with Tool Shed?
No, actually, this is the first time I've performed with mum since mum played for my diploma at music college, and then before then was when I was doing music festivals when I was little. So this is actually, yeah, it's been a while. So, but no, this is the first time, mum, isn't it, that you've been a part of something that isn't classical.
It's a great experience for me.
And Enloch, as Siming was saying, you've played classical music for a very long time. I get the impression that your entire family is quite creative and from an arts background. Is that accurate to say? Is there more that we should know about the family?
Yes, well, my father was a director of music in a boys' school for 28 years, and my mother graduated from the Shanghai Conservatoire, and she was taught by Liszt pupil's pupil, so Szilagyi's pupil. So, yeah, she's a great, you know, musician, and she still practices secretly.
A choir sings at the wedding. It must have been a lovely day. Her eyes closed. She is listening. Her head nods knowingly.
I've been looking back at some of the things you've done, and it seems to me that you seem to work collaboratively a lot. You've done soundtracks for, like I saw you did a soundtrack for the Maya Deren Meshes of the Afternoon,
yes.
And which is kind of a famous sort of mid-century silent film, isn't it? Do you find you enjoy working more with, you know, say like a poet providing lyrics or something like that? Do you always need someone to sort of stoke that creative fire in that way? Or?
Yeah, I mean, well, with the film, with the Maya Deren films, I've done a couple, and that was through Bird's Eye View. They commissioned me to make a live soundtrack, which I performed to. And I do love, I guess, yeah, collaboration with film and writing for moving image, and I hope to sort of continue doing that. So that, yeah, definitely sort of sparks an inspiration. And working with Judy was really, she's a really patient and inspiring lady to work with. So that was quite a lovely collaboration. Yeah, I guess I have collaborated with lots of different people as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Guest singing as well. And yeah.
I was also interested, some of the instruments you're using out there, I mean, it was like you explained you were using like an old BBC recorder for sort of backup vocals and stuff. And
yes.
And I also see that you play the dulcetone clarinet. Am I right in thinking that's more like a piano thing?
The dulcetone. I didn't bring that today.
No, you didn't bring it. I was looking it up. I was like, what is that?
I know, I've got a really bad back at the moment, so we decided to edit quite a lot of the instruments. So it's the same sort of hammer action as a piano, but instead of the strings, as you would have in a piano, you have these metal, like a glockenspiel, really, so bits. So it's kind of a tinkly sound. And so we'll be using that on the tour. I've got loads of old, ancient instruments, actually, at home, and I like to combine that with the electronic sound. So I've got a clavichord and two celestes. I've got a harpsichord in my hallway.
Gathering dust.
Yeah. No, I have to say, I might have to make that into a dining table, actually.
Hypnotize me with your eye contact. Helplessly, you know where to go.
That was Siming Toe speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall. And if you want to find out more about this intriguing artist, just go to siming.co.uk. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be hearing about the burgeoning scene for hand-printed gig poster art. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher turned this from a frog to a prince with her magic mixing skills. Time for one final song this week, and from a swerve away from usual form, because I mentioned Robert Wyatt in a link a little bit earlier on in the show, it got me thinking we don't play enough of him on the radio. I don't hear enough of him generally. He's a great man, a genius. I wanted to play you Heaps of Sheeps. It's from the 1997 record called Schleep. And check it out. You need to buy it. You need to buy it at least on CD, if not vinyl. It's got one of those beautiful covers as well. Here he is, Robert Wyatt with Heaps of Sheeps. Thanks for tuning in. I realize my fist was clenched. I stretch my